is...
Yeah, it's superficially we're talking
utter with your tongue, or, you know, I've read the Quran, I believe in God.
Yes.
It's believing that God actually is the
true
active
sovereign
live agent in one's life.
Life, yes.
As opposed to, you know, he created billions of years ago, now he's sitting on the side.
Side, yes.
Giving it, you know, let the Americans do it. Okay? This is, and let me be very open about this.
Yes.
And some people are not going to like this. It's a form of shirk.
Very beautifully
it's,
put.
They're mushrik.
And
we even have this in theology.
We do.
We have you know, tawhid-e zati. Mm. We have essential tawhid, which relates to the, you know, the existence of God. So we say, you know, there's only one God. And you know, most people, because they can't really fathom it on a deeper level, they say, of course, you know, we don't have multiple gods.
No.
Right? Then we have.
But they're talking.
Then
in
we
terms
have
tawhid-e
sifati, which is relates to. Sifat, which relates to the characteristics and the names of God.
Yes.
That, you know, even though there's different names of God, they are not in conflict with each other. This is what we talked about in the previous program.
Sure.
We said, you know, the vengeance and, you know, the justice is within His rahmah. So
yes,
these are not separate from each other.
No.
Okay? Now, and then we have, you know, this is where the people have a problem, which is, you know, it's called Tawhid Rububiyat, in His Rab, Him being the Lord.
Lord.
Actual Lord that does the things.
Yes, the sovereign
it's
Lord.
It's not simply some, you know, old man with a white beard in the sky.
Unfortunately,
you know. Okay?
Still with that
this,
kind of image.
This is where most of us become mushrik.
Mushrik.
And I'm talking about people who pray and fast and read the
yes,
Quran. And
exactly.
You know, are
because,
good Muslims.
Because I wanted to point out very quickly from the Holy Quran, especially this example is very, very crucial if you really want to believe as a Muslim, as someone who has submitted and surrendered himself to the Sovereign Lord is Hazrat Ibrahim alayhi salam.
Right.
Because he's the Hanif. He's the one who understood the ultimate reality, the ultimate sense of who his Lord actually is. And once you have that picture that this is the one who watches me, cares for me, provides for my provision, my sustenance, my life or my death, this is the reality on which we are weak. Are we not?
Let me give you an example,
please.
I'm assuming that we're going to get to the point in these so-called negotiations with the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
where the U.S. is going to say, we want this from you.
Mm-hmm.
The Iranians are going to say, we want this from you.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
sure.
Mutually
sure.
Wanting things.
Mutually, yeah.
Right? And you're not. Neither side is going to be able to deliver what the other side wants.
Exactly.
For many reasons.
Yes,
whether
of course.
It's related to domestic issues at home, whether the Congress, whether it's related to, you know, Iran having its red lines in terms of its sovereignty and you know, its national dignity.
Sure.
We're going to get to a point in these negotiations, and, you know, they're giving themselves 6 to 9 months. I think it's, you know, maybe a year.
Mm.
They're going to get to a point where they're like, you know what, we can't do this.
Yeah.
And then the Americans are going to go on TV and they're like, it was the Iranians' fault.
Their fault.
The people here in Iran who are, you know, dying to be, you know, Americans, you know, even though they look like monkeys when they imitate them. But anyways, they like to be American monkeys.
Sure.
Those in Iran will, you know, start writing their articles and their news, you know, they're going to go on and say, oh, you know, Iranians didn't, you know, play ball.
But play ball, yes. Right. They'll blame fellow Iranians.
Iranian officials are going to be like, no, the Americans were making outlandish demands. We couldn't give in to those demands. We wanted things from them. They weren't willing to do one single thing.
Sure.
So this whole thing is going to be over in a year.
Yeah, I think
okay?
so. Okay? I think so.
And we're going to go back to the way it was in terms of, you know, people understanding what the realities are.
Mm.
Okay? Mm. The problem is that, you know, certain people, I'm talking about Muslims, they don't understand that. Let's assume that this happens, that everything falls apart, and the Iranian officials are steadfast, saying, you know what, we're not going to submit to this, even though there might be pressure from the sanctions, even though there's going to be, you know, price issues and inflation and so on.
Absolutely.
We're not going to go begging to the taghut. We're not going to go begging to the zalim.
Exactly.
To the oppressor, right?
Yeah.
And imagine if this happens, and then God suddenly turns the whole thing around.
Ah. Because that's something that does happen.
Because that's what he tells you. He says in the Quran, he says, you know, shaitan, you know, threatens you and scares you with
poverty
and corruption.
Corruption.
And izzat is from me.
Me.
And I give you, and I promise you honor and izzat and dignity.
Yes.
Okay. Now, wouldn't it be nice if some of these people in Iran would actually think about what God is telling them?
Exactly.
And didn't we see it happening in these years?
Yes.
Wherever we stood up, for Islam,
yes,
we followed what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala was telling us in the Quran, and what the Prophet was telling us and what the Aimé were telling us, when we did that, we were successful. You know, there's Ali Karachi, who's famous in Iran. I'm sure you've seen him, you know,
sure, on TV.
You know, he's the one that did the whole literacy campaign after the revolution, you know. And he says, don't say America when you're not doing well. Don't say it's America. Say Israf. Say that you've been wasteful. Because when you're wasteful,
nice.
Allah takes away the things that He's giving you. So we have a society when people are wasteful, they don't you know, thank God for the blessings that they have. They don't reflect on what happened, you know, 2 days ago in their life.
Yes.
When Allah honored them with, you know, the way they were trying to go on that path of Quran, and where they failed and they were in misery when they were groveling at the feet of some you know, lords, you know, quote unquote, other than God. So what do you think is going to happen? If you go with God, not only is it a promise in the Quran, but our life in these years has shown this.
Yes.
Okay.
And you're an independent sovereign nation in these years.
All the sanctions, and look, in terms of, you know...
And the world acknowledges that.
In terms of knowledge and create, you know...
Creativity, innovation.
And in terms of, you know,
technological
standard of living.
Progress and advance.
I mean, look at the standard of living. If you compare it to 40 years ago, it's not comparable.
It's not comparable.
You know,
it's
a whole different world.
No,
you know, you
had
a situation, a country where people were peasants, where they were illiterate.
Yes.
And now it's like, you know, everybody's got, you know, their mobile, everybody's got, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Everything that, you know, you would expect a normal average person in the West to have.
To be honest, I have been to Tehran, and I sometimes think that people have a better standard of living than many people in European nations, and I know
exactly, like we talked about.
Yeah,
you
from
know?
Personal experience,
you know,
I can see that.
An average person in Iran, even though there's, you know, high prices.
A lot of difficulty,
right?
High prices, yes.
But on the average person, the middle class person in Iran, has a better quality of life than an average person in, you know.
In Europe.
Pick a city.
Athens.
No, I'm talking about even, you know...
Yeah, in Birmingham.
London.
Birmingham,
you know, Liverpool.
You know, Manchester.
You know?
Hull.
Glasgow.
Glasgow's a bit better.
Right.
Hull's one of the worst places in Britain.
Or some place in France or in Germany.
Yeah.
So the point is that Imam, when he starts saying these things, when he says it's the great Satan, when he says they are the root of all problems in the world, and he said this...
That's right. The root of all problems in this world. Exactly. Yeah.
You had Bush and Condi Rice and those guys
deciding,
you know what? Because at that time, Bandar, our old friend.
Oh, yeah, Bandar.
He had left as ambassador of the U.S. and his half-brother, I think it was Faisal or Turkey, or one of them.
Right, I remember that.
Right? Had come as the new ambassador.
New ambassador.
Okay, and he was a little bit more moderate, a little bit more worldly, and a little bit more, you know, diplomatic.
Mm.
And he basically said to the Americans, and the Americans and together, they decided, you know what, with this whole Iraq thing happening, with this whole Afghanistan thing happening, it would be good if we try to be a little, you know, a little rapprochement with Iran wouldn't hurt us. Right?
Yeah.
With this whole Israel under attack and, you know, Hezbollah and all that. Let's see what we can do here.
Yeah.
To this level, we're not talking about a real opening.
Yeah, yeah,
we're
yeah.
talking about, let's take away this hostility a little, this rhetoric a little, let's step it back.
Mm.
You know, I'm sure the Saudis were like, well, we can be, you know, we can mediate. Whatever.
Mediate, yes, yes.
Okay, so this is the Saudi ambassador in Washington saying this.
Yes.
Bandar gets a whiff of it back in Riyadh.
Mm.
Gets on his private jet, flies straight to Andrews Air Force Base.
Right.
Gets off the plane, goes to Condi and says, you can't do this.
Oh.
What do you mean, friends with Iran? Are you nuts? Right? What do you mean, rapprochement? What do you mean, you know?
Well, I'll give it to Bandar. At least he understands that aspect of everything.
Listen, it was so bad that, whatever, Faisal Turki, whoever it was, he resigned as an ambassador.
My goodness.
He said, I'm the ambassador.
Yeah.
What are you flying
over here for? Exactly.
And once he realized that it's not, you know, there's issues, namely that, you know, the Israelis and the Saudis, Bandar and Bibi. Bandar
are not
going to
allow.
That's good. We got to get it.
Yeah, Bandar and Bibi, yeah.
Bibi, Bandar.
Bibi. It sounds like, you know, the Bush-Blair Corporation, BBC, but there we are. It's very good. Yes,
right?
Bandar and Bibi.
He had decided, you know, that, you know what, we need to, you know, whatever, cripple Iran or whatever.
Yeah, that's right.
Iran.
Yeah.
You know, who cares what Faisal Turki...
Yeah. But
So he resigned. He was ambassador for 15 months.
Sure.
Less than, you know, a little bit more than a year. After a while, he's like, you know what? I'm out of here.
Mm.
because this is I can't work like this. I'm discussing things, and then this guy flies in. What I'm trying to explain is that this is nothing new.
No.
We had this during the Bush era you know, Bandar came and said, you know, canceled what, all options on the table.
Sure.
And as, you know, usual, Condi and, you know, George and Donald and Dick. And
yes,
you know,
Donald Dick, yes, that's right. It makes a whole difference from Donald Duck, yes. But we're talking about the same kind of politics.
Exactly.
Yes,
all of them saluted, yes, sir.
Yes.
Okay, and yes. you know,
as Donald Duck would.
You know, Bandar was threatening them. You know,
yes,
he wasn't asking.
Yeah, yeah.
He was saying,
no,
you know what? We'll just go give our oil to
the
Chinese. Forget about dollar denomination.
Sure.
Of oil. Forget about allowing your ships access. You know, we're gonna play you like we always do.
Do
crudely and openly and hard fisted and ham fisted.
Yes.
Okay.
Sure.
And they all said, you know what? You know, sorry.
Yes.
Sorry for mentioning.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So. Fast forward to this.
This, yes.
You know,
yeah.
You know, Mr. Zarif does his thing, talking, you know,
sure.
Smiling, you know, negotiation.
Sure.
And what happens? Who flies in? Last time it was Bandar. This time it was Bibi.
Bibi.
All right? Flies in.
Flies in. And dictates to
and says to,
yeah,
you know,
Obama, let's
Hussein.
Not have any of this.
And remember, his name is Hussein, right?
Yes.
To Hussein.
Yeah, to Hussein. We're not having any of this. Tighten the sanctions.
This is a, you know, a wolf in sheep's clothing. This
yeah.
is all lies.
Yes.
The Iranians are liars. They're genetically liars.
Yes.
It's all lies.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Very racist.
Oh, he
way.
Is.
By
he
the
is
way,
is
just very kind of crude.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, imagine saying these generalities about Jews. Imagine what
uh-huh,
crazy
yes.
thing
oh,
would happen in the
goodness,
world.
The media would have a
you
field
know,
day.
If Ali Zarif or Ali Rouhani
yes,
would go in and be like, you know, the Jews can't be trusted because they always, you know, look after.
Yeah, and then
they're always looking out for number
see,
one. You know, if somebody were to say, oh, the Jews always looking out for number one, always playing everyone. How dare anybody even say that, right? And I don't believe that that's the case with all Jews, but hey, somebody could look at history and say this is something they do.
Do, yeah.
Now imagine somebody saying that. No, but Bibi is allowed to come and say every insult
to Iran?
To Iranians.
Yes.
And, you know, their character.
Say all those lies.
All those things that they have to know. They're lying. You know, the religious leader is lying about not wanting atomic weapons. This is all a ruse. This is all, you know, whatever.
Sure.
Okay? And what does Hussein do? All options are
all back on the table.
Don't worry about it.
Don't
we will get all we need to get out of Iran.
Sure.
Okay? So, this is who we're dealing with. This is why the Supreme Leader said, you know, we have nothing against people talking to each other,
sure.
but you have to remember who the party on the other side is.
Yes.
You shouldn't forget who they are.
Who they are.
Okay?
Exactly.
And some people, unfortunately, in Iran...
Still don't get that.
And in the Islamic world, still don't understand
Stand
who
that.
America is. They still have goodwill to them. They still think, and this to me is not evidence of their goodness. The people who have this in their heart,
sure,
is not evidence that they're good people.
No,
it's evidence that they are ignorant, that they have a disease in their heart.
Heart, yes.
That they have a flaw in their character.
If you don't mind me saying, Dr. Madhichap, because you know, in the last couple of minutes, I think Egypt's a wonderful example of what's exactly happening at the moment. They tried to be everything to everyone, especially to the U.S. And what happens? They get hijacked. And this is exactly the sort of thing that, thank God, with the leadership of Imam Khomeini, because this program is dedicated to the man who changed the world. Really, I mean, all my hat goes off to him every time that, you know, really this man was remarkable. That, you know, he had that foresight, that, you know, that vision, that he saw exactly things for what they were. And, you know, he clarified it for us. And this is why you've survived these 35 years. And God willing, if you carry on like that, and I love the fact that Bibi keeps doing that thing where he says, oh, we're a moment away by tightening the sanctions. Yes, we are a moment away by becoming even more independent and more stronger than we've ever been before.
And look, who is the crazy one now?
Yeah, who's the crazy
Who's the one that everybody's making fun of?
Sure.
Who is the one they're like,
yeah,
the
people are
laughing crazy.
Him out of the room.
Right? Just think about the people that Americans and the British elites have, you know, allied themselves with.
Exactly.
It's, you know, animals,
Bandar and Bibi
animals
show.
Like Bandar and Bibi.
Bandar and Bibi show.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, of all the people in the world
for goodness sake.
You're going to be allied with,
yeah.
of all the people you're going to allow them to fly in their private jet into Andrews Fairs and come to you privately.
Yeah.
You're getting Bandar to come? who, you know, is funding the people who chop off heads with kitchen knives.
That's right. Christian priests who had their heads hacked off.
People who,
saws?
Yeah, who like yeah. they cut open the chests and take out hearts
and put them in.
And he likes it. Believe he likes it. Oh, yeah. Don't think he's like revolted by it. Oh, no, I'm holding my nose.
No.
He's like, go do this.
Go and do this.
Because this will show our power, and this will show how you know you can't mess with us.
Yes,
you know.
Exactly.
And then Bibi, that you know, who's you know. You know, I like to call him, you know, Bibi Smuts.
Yeah.
You know, like Jan. Actually, Jan Smuts wasn't that bad. You know, Bota, Bibi
yeah.
Bota. You know,
Bibi Bota.
Right. You know, who just hangs in there with apartheid. You know, the whole world is like, dude. You know, chill out on this. You know, separate roads.
Yes.
You know, for Palestinians and for Jews.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
And no, he's like, no. That's it. We're sticking to this. You know. So, these are the people that Western elites have allied themselves with. And the question for us.
Yes.
And the issue that we have to think about,
sure.
and the issue that our listeners should, in my view,
yes,
consider and reflect on,
yes.
is not that you have animals like Bibi and Bandar in the world. They've always existed.
They've always existed.
They've always done these things.
Yes.
The issue is, why would those people who are the elites, who are, you know, from your homes and your families and your colleges and your towns,
have any expectations of them?
And your churches and your synagogues and your, you know, mosques. Why would these people who, you know, they're your cousins, they're your dads, your uncles, your, you know, brothers, your husbands, your wives, why would they even look at these people like Bibi and Bandar and consider them even worthy of their
attention?
Right. Where there's other people that they could be, you know, a nice, civilized, educated person.
Yes.
Okay? So the point I'm trying to simply make is, you know, why wouldn't you want to have good relations with a country like Iran, that is a republic,
sure.
that has elections, that has, you know, a deep, you know, complex structure where people are involved, where you have local elections, where you have 800,000, you know, people in this population running for.
Well, I think
that you have a leader who talks about, you know, progress and standard of living and, you know, healthcare and education and technology and, you know, the main thing in life being that you have more knowledge. Why would you not align yourself with that and align yourself with Bandar?
Well, I think the other thing is that, you know, honestly, that the, you know, we come back to that NAM summit as well. I think that in itself said everything, that, you know, the majority of nations in this world are tired of this hegemony and they really do want to ally themselves with Iran. And, you know, wanting to make broader ties and expand ties and, you know, to learn about this Islamic civilization as well, as we've discussed before. And it just leaves me to say, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you very much for listening.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
The Weight of Chains, Part 2.
Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. Milosevic reigned over what was left of Yugoslavia as it fell apart in the 1990s, surviving crippling UN sanctions, wars in Slovenia, Croatia, and Bosnia, violent Albanian separatism in Kosovo, NATO airstrikes against his country, an ICTY war crimes indictment, and 40 years of marriage with a control freak wife, Milosevic was definitely a force to be reckoned with. Naturally, such media were always described in NED literature as independent. The Democratic opposition refused to participate in the second round and called for a general strike.
Tens of thousands have answered the call of the Democratic opposition of Serbia for a five-day campaign of civil disobedience. The mass protests have already begun in Belgrade and other cities. Strikes and boycotts are also planned in a concerted effort to force Milosevic to accept the opposition's general election victory.
Sever had over 4,000 employees in the year 2000. After being sold to the Austrian company ATB in 2014, it had just 370 employees. However, in the next 3 months, by the end of 2000, Serbia had an average increase of prices by 52%. Thanks to stabilization, many domestic companies which could do good business had to close down. The West isolating and attacking Yugoslavia from 1992 to 2000 did great harm to the economy. But it seems that the West supposedly helping Yugoslavia as of 2000 made many things even worse. Why? From a historical standpoint, this made more sense.
Is it Greece? No. Is it the French Riviera? No. Is it Turkey? Austria? Switzerland? Rome? No. It's all Yugoslavia. A fascinating blend of all that attracts the traveler to Europe.
The country itself can best be described as the best of Europe.
Yugoslavia was an important player in the world, especially after World War II, when the United States took on the Soviet Union and made it its chief enemy. When Tito split from Stalin and formed a third way, not only Tito, this includes Nehru in India, includes Tito, it includes Sukarno in Indonesia, and Gabdel Abdel Nasser in Egypt, and Nkrumah in Ghana. These are hugely rich countries with huge resources.
The socialist Yugoslavia was, in a way, a Casablanca of the Cold War. We were, neither in the West nor in the East, and we had relations with both. And Yugoslavia, as a leader of the non-aligned movement, had a role to play in this divided
world. There was a desire for neutrality, to avoid the arms buildup, to waste money, to use the resources of these countries to help people in their countries.
However, shortly after the split with the Soviets in 1948, Yugoslavia, still shattered after World War II, needed to consolidate its economy and began to receive loans from the United States and the World Bank. The lives of those partisans were the price for the consolidation of Yugoslavia's economy. It didn't matter that Yugoslavia declared itself neutral.
John Foster Dulles, who was Eisenhower's Secretary of State, very clearly said that neutrality was immoral. It's just a strange concept, but that was his attitude, that communism had to be rolled back. So the U.S. was taking a very aggressive position. Three of these five people that I mentioned were removed with the participation of the United States from power. Only two made it. Tito, who was a giant, because he fought as a partisan, he had a strong army and he had a strong base, and he was able to say no to Stalin. At the same time, the U.S. could not get in with him.
But the U.S. was able to slowly creep in with their loans.
The IMF was making loans into this region and, in a sense, not helping the situation financially. The U.S. had no interest in helping this situation heal itself.
But that, after all, is what neoliberalism was all about. The ideological foundation of what we call neoliberalism today was given by Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich von Hayek, two Austrian economists. Mises believed that egoism was the prime law of society, while Hayek claimed that a free market creates a spontaneous order that fixes the issues of economic calculation. In essence, neoliberals demand that you deregulate the market, privatize almost everything, cut government services, and by doing so, they believe the economy will pretty much fix itself. In 1947, an organization called the Mont Pelerin Society was formed to bring together neoliberal intellectuals around the world. The goal of the Mont Pelerin Society was not to convince the masses that neoliberalism was the way to go, as they considered the people to be mere followers of the elite. They shifted their attention to winning sympathies of intellectuals worldwide. A prominent member of the Mont Pelerin Society, called Milton Friedman, decided to get the ball rolling. As the leader of the Chicago School of Economics, Friedman started collaborating with the Catholic University of Chile, from which students were sent to the University of Chicago and were indoctrinated with neoliberalism. They returned to Chile and were ready to shape Chile's economy after the democratically elected government of President Salvador Allende was overthrown in a CIA-backed coup led by Augusto Pinochet on September 11, 1973.
Chile was a case in which a military regime headed by Pinochet was willing to switch the organization of the economy, and in that process, a group of people who had been trained at the University of Chicago in the Department of Economics, who came to be called the Chicago Boys, played a major role in designing and implementing the economic reforms.
Milton Friedman was also personally involved in the Chile experiment.
Well, I did make a trip to Chile, and I made talks in Chile. In fact, I did meet with Mr. Pinochet.
As they listened to Friedman's advice, the economy slowly started collapsing, even though the elites, together with Friedman, were convincing the people that they were building a better society.
If you want to live in a society where your compatriots are poor and you are rich, and you think that's better, a better society, then you would like it.
A Chilean family trying to live on the average wage had to spend 75% of its income on bread. Riding the bus or drinking milk became luxuries. Those who revolted were put in concentration camps. 100,000 people were jailed, thousands were killed.
I am more than willing to share in the credit for the extraordinary job that our students did down there.
In neighboring Argentina, President Isabel Perón was overthrown in a military coup, and as Friedman's disciples filled key economic positions in the country, within a year of the coup, wages dropped by 40%, factories closed, poverty spread, dissidents simply disappeared. The neoliberal coups didn't stop there. After Latin America, the economic policies of Milton Friedman spread to Western countries themselves. In Britain, Margaret Thatcher defeated the biggest union in the country, the mining union, and pushed through the neoliberal reforms, selling off the steel industry, water, electricity, gas, telephones, airlines, oil, and cutting many social programs. America, with President Ronald Reagan, did much of the same, widening the gap between the rich and the poor. The big prize, of course, was the Soviet Union.
Having won the Cold War, and that led, of course, to the breakup of the Soviet Empire, both in the Warsaw Pact and Eastern European countries and within the Soviet Union itself, that has helped contribute to a movement toward democracy.
In fact, democracy was to be quickly trumped by Western financial interests. While Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev propagated a gradual transition to Scandinavian-style socialism with help from the West, he didn't understand what kind of help the West was ready to give.
The U.S. could have prevented the meltdown of the Soviet economy with an infusion of aid after Gorbachev withdrew the troops from Eastern Europe, but did not do so.
Few people knew what a radical transformation of the economy meant for the newly established Russian Federation. As a matter of fact, many Russian intellectuals were behind President Boris Yeltsin, whose advisors were also Friedman's disciples.
The Moscow intellectuals, you couldn't tell them what it was like. They were saying, oh, the poorest people in your country live better than I do. Here's a guy sitting there, he had a small apartment, okay, a wall of books, educated at Moscow University, speaks fluent English, never went hungry one day in his life. And we would say, well, we have people who live in doorways. They sleep in doorways. They eat out of garbage cans. I've seen them myself. And they say, oh, you don't have to lie to us. Oh, they don't. They would not believe it. America, America.
Yeah, you want America? You'll get America. A small number of businessmen in Russia became billionaires, better known as oligarchs, while a third of all Russians dropped below the poverty line. State industries were sold off at bargain prices. Boris Yeltsin, with full support of America, dissolved parliament as only a dictator could ensure the implementation of Friedman's economic policies. I think you get the picture here. Neoliberalism was imposed in dictatorships and in states of emergency, while the population was in shock. Something author Naomi Klein coined as the shock doctrine. The pioneer of shock therapy was an economist named Jeffrey Sachs, who traveled and administered his economic therapy to patient countries designated by the West. In 1991, Božidar Djelić, who would later become Serbia's Minister of Economy and Finances after Milosevic was deposed, met Jeffrey Sachs, who recruited him for 3 years of service in Poland and Russia as a top-level advisor to those countries' neoliberal reforms. In an interview for Harvard Business School, Djelić described the reforms as being honest with the patient and administering the dose of medicine required for recovery. Because when a patient needs to recover, shock is definitely the best medicine, eh? When I look at all the chaos that happened in all those countries, from the coups in Latin America, the Falklands War that allowed Thatcher to push through her policies, to the burning White House in Moscow after Yeltsin ordered its shelling, I can't help but wonder whether the burning Yugoslav Parliament building and TV station was meant to have the same effect. Maybe instead of looking at the smoke, we should have been looking what had already happened next door. This led to a hyperinflation in Croatia, This monetary policy, known as the quasi-fixed exchange rate, wasn't new. It was first adopted by Thailand in the 1980s. The way it works is you tie your country's official exchange rate to another country's currency. In this case, Croatia tied it to the euro. This creates the illusion of a fluctuating exchange rate, the illusion of a Croatian currency. Makes you wonder who runs the show when it comes to the Croatian economy. Was this the Croatia that its first president, Franjo Tuđman, had promised to the people when it declared independence from Yugoslavia in 1991, triggering a bloody war that lasted 4 years? A high-ranking official in Tuđman's party, the Croatian Democratic Union, or HDZ, in the 1990s, Domagoj Margetić, saw Tuđman's project in a different light from how the Croatian media presented him. This was the case in other countries as well during the Yugoslav wars, and money seemed to be a higher interest than winning territories through war, which even brought some leaders on opposite sides of the conflict together. Bora Milosevic was Slobodan Milosevic's brother. You can imagine how soldiers shooting at each other on the battlefield would feel if they knew their leaders and their families were working together on getting extremely rich. The project of dismantling a socialist country to create a rich minority and a poor majority is what neoliberalism was all about. This is why all of it was wholeheartedly supported by the West. Publicly, the West was condemning war profiteering and crimes against humanity. The International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, better known as the Hague Tribunal, was put in charge of punishing those who committed crimes. The chief prosecutor of the tribunal was Carlo Del Ponte.
I was all my life prosecutor in Switzerland, and Switzerland wanted to present me as candidate for the International Tribunal for former Yugoslavia, I said yes, because it was a new experience, a new challenge.
A challenge that proved to be quite difficult at times, especially when it came to investigating perhaps the most gruesome case of crimes against humanity and war profiteering there is, organ trafficking, which took place in Kosovo during the war.
In 1999, Kosovo Albanians put over 300 hostages in trucks and transported them across the border to northern Albania.
Before killing Serbs and members of other ethnic communities, Kosovo Albanians removed their vital organs and sold them for transplant.
The butchering reportedly took place in the Katuchi family house, which was dubbed the Yellow House, near the town of Burel in Albania.
I received a report about this issue, and I must say, at the very beginning, I did not believe it. I said, it's not possible. But the evidences we got confirms that it was reality, so it was my duty as prosecutor to continue this investigation. Unfortunately, it was not possible to continue.
Why not?
Because we have no cooperation. Albania was refusing us to investigate in the country because we have some indications that it was a mass grave there. UNMIC was not full cooperating with us, so we were obliged to suspend the investigation.
The head of UNMIC was Bernard Kouchner, and no one could explain why this investigation was being obstructed. When asked by a reporter if he himself was involved in the organ smuggling, Kouchner took it very seriously. One of those idiots and murderers, as Kouchner would describe them, would have to be, I guess, Swiss prosecutor to the Council of Europe, Dick Marty, as well, as he too talked about the Yellow House. In his 2010 report, Dick Marty uncovered that Hashim Thaçi, who was the prime minister of the self-proclaimed Republic of Kosovo at the time the report came out, was the head of a mafia-like group responsible for smuggling weapons, drugs, and human organs through Europe. As stated in the report, the so-called Kosovo Liberation Army, or KLA, held prisoners in a network of 6 facilities located in Albania, and Thaçi's Drenica group had the greatest responsibility for the prisons and the fate of those held there. The healthiest prisoners were transferred to a farmhouse near Fusha Kruja, where they were killed for their organs. Why didn't the West react?
Because Kylie was supporting NATO during the conflict, they had some difficulty to cooperate with us against the people who helped them. You know, it is politically, if you are my associate in a conflict, how can you act against, against my associate.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today we're going to be examining the problem of the necessity of prophethood and why is it necessary for God to send prophets to human beings. Now, we've been examining this problem from a number of different points of view, and we said that one of the things that human beings need in order for them to be happy, for them to be fulfilled, for them to be felicitous and achieve felicity in this world and in the hereafter, is for them to have a knowledge of God, for them to have a knowledge of their creator, the being who created them. And we said that this is something that they cannot achieve and cannot arrive at without the assistance of the divine revelation. We said that some people might object to this by saying that we see that in history there were certain thinkers who arrived at this knowledge, who arrived at this conclusions, the same beliefs and conclusions that divine revelation talks to us and tells us about, without the assistance of God, without the assistance of divine revelation and prophecy. They thought about the matter. They thought about God, they pondered over the matter, and they arrived at the conclusion that God exists. They arrived at the conclusion that He's one, that He has knowledge, that He has life. All of the divine properties that Revelation speaks about, these thinkers also believed in without the help of the prophets. So who said that prophecy is required? Who said prophecy is necessary? And who said that we need divine revelation to be felicitous in this world and the hereafter? We've been examining this question and looking at it from different points of view. Today we want to examine it from another point of view. That point of view is this, that reasoning, in order for us to understand this, the answer to this question, we have to understand the nature of the human knowledge and the nature of the human intellect and reasoning, and that's this, that the conclusions that reason arrives at are universal and general in nature. They're very limited. Reasoning, when left on its own, right, without the assistance of some other faculty, regardless of whether that faculty is a faculty within himself or outside of himself, it can only arrive at certain universal conclusions. It can't arrive at the details about certain specific things. For example, without opening your eyes and looking outside, you can't say your power of reasoning cannot tell you whether it's night or whether it's day, right? The faculties of the senses, they have to be assisted. They have to assist the faculty of the intellect in order for you to arrive at this conclusion. Why? It's because this is not something that human reasoning can understand. So human reasoning, when left on its own, can only arrive at certain general conclusions, certain universal conclusions. But these universal conclusions are not enough for to arrive at that knowledge, that understanding, and that awareness, which is necessary for that felicity that we're speaking about. For example, the human understanding understands and recognizes that God is just and that he should recompense the people that have been oppressed in this world, in another world. But what exactly is oppression? Also, it understands that oppression means that, for example, a certain right is taken away from a certain human being by another human being. But exactly what are the rights of human beings, and how they, what exactly are the specific instances of these rights and the instances of oppression? This is not something that human beings can understand. Or, for example, the details of the hereafter. It understands that there has to be another world, a hereafter, in which human beings are recompensed for their actions or the oppressions that have been committed upon them. But what exactly are the details of that world? It's not something that the faculty of reasoning can understand without the assistance of revelation. And this is necessary. It's a necessary knowledge. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were examining the necessity of prophethood and revelation. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Aga, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
In the limelight. According to If Americans Knew, the U.S. supports Israel with $10.5 million in military aid every day. That is despite the growing economic despair in the United States and having a dilapidated infrastructure. We now present you an article written by Marzia Hashemi, a Tehran-based American journalist, political analyst, and newscaster, and a Press TV journalist. The piece is titled, Is Israel Worth It? Revolutionary is defined as involving or causing a complete and dramatic change. On 11th of February 1979, Iran started the process with the victory of the Islamic Revolution, and that would cause a dramatic change in Iran, as well as the region and the wider world. On 19th of February 1979, the first Palestinian embassy in the world opened in Tehran. Just over 1 week after its own revolutionary victory, Iran not only talked about its support for the Palestinians, but acted upon it. The Israeli embassy was closed down and the Palestinian embassy was opened immediately. Even in the middle of a transition of political systems and with so much pressure on this newly post-revolutionary country, the Palestinians were remembered by the Iranian leadership and told that they had Tehran's support. What a message is sent around the world. However, Tehran had entered a realm that no one or no establishment is allowed to go without paying a price, and that is going against the Zionist regime. But when countries support Israel, they pay an even higher price, and that is the loss of their sovereignty. Just ask the American people about this and the cost they have had to pay for supporting Tel Aviv. According to If Americans Knew, the U.S. supports Israel with $10.5 million in military aid every day. That is despite the growing economic despair in the United States and having a dilapidated infrastructure. After an increasing popularity of the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement, or BDS movement globally, to put pressure on the Zionist regime, at least for its illegal settlement activities, that according to the United Nations are illegal, 27 states in the United States made it illegal to boycott Israel. It means more than 250 million Americans living in those states, or 78% of the population of the United States, do not have the right to even promote the idea of not buying products from Israel. This is according to Human Rights Watch. And American academics know very well that they can criticize their own country easier than they're allowed to criticize Israel. The red lines have been defined and reinforced with the firing or denial of tenure of professors who dare to criticize the Tel Aviv regime. Just ask Professor Stephen Salater, who was denied a tenured position that he had been offered, and even he had been given up his previous tenured position, and he and his wife were in the process of moving to the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. However, in the interim, Stephen Salater made the fatal mistake of criticizing the Israeli regime in a couple of tweets during the summer of 2014, while Israel was involved in a brutal bombing campaign of the Gaza Strip. He tweeted, "Only Israel can murder around 300 children in the span of a few weeks and insist that it is the victim." And in another tweet, Stephen Salater wrote, "If Netanyahu appeared on television with a necklace made from the teeth of Palestinian children, would anybody be surprised?" Shortly afterwards, he was informed that the offer for him to join the staff of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign would be rescinded. Then there is the case of Professor Norman Finkelstein, who is a renowned political science professor as well as extreme critic of the Israeli regime. After his lectures and writings criticizing the Zionist regime, Finkelstein was denied tenure at DePaul University. This took place in 2007, and since then he has been unable to get a job at any university or even a high school, for that matter, in the United States. And then we have the pressure on journalists to acquiesce to Israel's sovereignty in the United States. There is the case of Helen Thomas, who served 57 years as a White House correspondent and was recorded by a rabbi in an interview saying Israelis should go back to their countries like Germany, Poland, the United Kingdom, wherever they came from. She was forced to resign after being a correspondent for almost six decades. And there is a case of CNN contributor and academic Mark Lamont Hill. He was speaking at a United Nations session. He called for countries to boycott and divest from the occupied Palestinian territories in conjunction with the United Nations International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. Mark Lamont Hill said, "We have an opportunity to not just offer solidarity in words, but to commit to political action, grassroots action, local action and international action that will give us what justice requires, and that is a free Palestine from the river to the sea." He was immediately fired from CNN. He had crossed the red line. He could have criticized American policy, but he had chosen to criticize Israeli policy, and that would not be tolerated. That makes one think that Israel is more of a priority in the United States than Americans and the U.S. itself. And if we look at some of America's political representatives, that certainly seems to be the case. Whether we start years ago, when Israel attacked a U.S. naval vessel, the USS Liberty, in 1967, or we look at the present, we see that American politicians have been compromised. Back in 1967, when Lyndon Johnson was president, the Israelis attacked an American ship on purpose. Survivors of the ship have testified to this, as they were attacked more than once by the Israeli Air Force, even after identifying the ship as American. More than 800 rounds of artillery were fired at the ship. When word reached the Americans in the region that the Liberty was under attack, the U.S. carrier Saratoga was deployed along with 12 fighter jets. However, Washington ordered them to turn around and to stand down. Some 34 crew members of the Liberty were killed, and 174 crew members were wounded. U.S. President at the time, Lyndon Johnson, did not allow a thorough investigation to take place of the incident, and after only 1 week declared that it had been a case of mistaken identity. The U.S. government ordered a media blackout, and crew members of the Liberty were given a gag order and could not talk about what had happened until many years later. 2018, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, while addressing the Israeli-American Council in Florida, said, "If this capital crumbles to the ground, the one thing that would remain is our commitment to our aid and our cooperation with Israel." This definitely sounds like confused allegiance at best. And of course, she's not alone, and the majority of politicians in Washington show their commitment to Israel, or they're not likely to get re-elected. And even if we look at the judicial and intelligence realms in the United States, we see that those areas have also been compromised in favor of the Zionist regime. There's the case of American intelligence contractor Jonathan Pollard, who spied for Israel and gave Tel Aviv sensitive information about the United States. Pollard was given a life sentence for espionage, which U.S. defense and intelligence experts said had caused a lot of damage. However, after serving 30 years, he was released at the end of 2020. And he and his wife moved permanently to the occupied Palestinian territories. He was given a hero's welcome upon arrival in the occupied Palestinian lands. Does this not say that in the United States, Israel takes precedence over Americans? And finally, even during this COVID-19 pandemic, which has left the United States struggling, the administration passed the first stimulus package, allegedly designed to help Americans, and $600 per person were allotted. In the same package, $500 million were earmarked for Israel, which according to Tel Aviv has a population of just 9 million. You do the math on this one. The question some Americans are asking is why? Why does it seem that Israel has pervaded all aspects of American society? Why is Israel more important than Americans themselves? And how much longer will Americans tolerate playing second fiddle in their own country? Those who are in the camp of the resistance pay a price for standing up against Israel, but those who support Tel Aviv pay a much higher price. Perhaps Americans will realize what a liability Israel is for them, and they too can decide to make a complete and revolutionary change to their system and become a sovereign nation.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.